Chapter 28. My Angel, Angela. One of the things I love most about receptionists is that they have to be nice to you. The same is true of waitresses and barmaids, although masseuses don't seem to have got the memo. It's vital that members of these professions, often women, but it's now also legal for men, smile warmly and show a keen interest in what you did at the weekend. Of course, if they're not up to this, nobody will mind and they can go and find themselves another job. Not willing to go quietly? No problem. A quiet word with the office manager from one of the more senior members of staff should see them being shown the door within 24 hours. Thankfully, there were no such issues with Angela. I'll never forget the day we met. Not literally, can't remember the date. But more in the general sense that she would come to assume a prominent role in my life. But also in the life of the radio station. We had to let 6 receptionists go in little more than a year, and what the front desk badly needed was a period of stability. Right from the start, Angela just got my sense of humour. She got where my humour was coming from, and she got what I was trying to achieve with it. Some of my stuff can be pretty out there. Footnote. Think Richard Hammond, but more so. I know our previous few receptionists had struggled to tune into it, but not Angela. There wasn't just chemistry between us, there was physics too. Hers wasn't an obvious kind of beauty, and I liked that. You had to put in a bit of effort to spot it. Particularly if she'd had a couple of snifters the night before. But take your time, be prepared to look at her from a wide range of angles, and you would eventually strike gold. Not that I'm an oil painting myself. I'm a middle-aged man who is acutely aware of his own physical imperfections. I may have genuinely world-class hair and a genuinely world-class way of styling it, but in other ways, e.g. fat back, I'm far from a perfect specimen. So it's just as well that there is more to love than giving someone an arbitrary mark out of 10 for how attractive they are. So what if I was 6 and she was an 8, or if I was an 8 and she was a 6, which is what it was? Far more significant is the complex interplay of a whole range of intangibles, from pheromones to personality to hygiene, and the ladies I date must be clean. The first time I ever tongue-shagged Angela, i.e. kissed her, was when we were both being held hostage by DJ gone berserk Pat Farrell. That might seem counterintuitive, but when you're staring death in the face, it can make you profoundly randy. 24 hours later, the siege was over, miraculously without a single casualty, footnote, with the exception of Michael, who died. So in the weeks that followed, Angela and I were free to take our relationship to the next level, away from the glare of the world's media and a sad Irishman with a shotgun. It was a chance we seized with both of our 4 hands. We progressed from gentle kissing to heavy petting in, what, 6 days? Sure, there were moments when we'd get a bit handy with each other, but generally it was a phase dominated by lots and lots of snogging. Now, when you've been snogging a long time, as I have, you get a pretty good feel for the strengths and weaknesses of your technique. Personally, I'm a fairly accomplished all-rounder, as comfortable nibbling a lip as I am when the mouths go wide. Meanwhile, regular Murray minting means my breath is always in great condition. My one flaw, other than dribbling, is that during standing up snogs, I have a tendency to overlean. On first dates, when the woman's not been briefed, this will usually mean she's forced backwards and onto the floor. But in later dates, with everything now out in the open, a wall or bus shelter is usually sufficient as a backstop. In my 20s, I worried that this tendency on my part may have come across as slightly forward or predatory, but as I've got older, I've come to accept that this loss of balance is more likely a problem with my inner ear. It'd be an exaggeration to say that Angela and I kissed for days at a time, but snogs of between 8 and 10 minutes certainly weren't unusual. I'm a keen stats man, so I made it my business to time our kisses and jot down the results in a notebook. It made for fascinating reading. She tended to be the one to end the snogs. Angela wasn't a very good nose breather, with our briefest normally in the morning before I'd brushed my teeth, and our longest either on the occasions we'd stop in a lay-by on the way home or when she was leathered. The fact that we worked in the same building meant we were able to see lots of each other, and Frenchie sessions would often take place during my show. The best time was after I'd thrown to the lunchtime news, when we had about 40 minutes to really go at it. Simon was often in the studio with us, but it wasn't a problem because he had his magazines. Post-snog, we'd typically find ourselves extremely hungry, and Simon would be dispatched to get us a nice salad from McDonald's. With the studio to ourselves, Angela would discuss the key elements of the snog. I liked how you kept licking the roof of my mouth, or whatever, and I'd just quietly listen and stare at her. Of course, the next stage was outright sex, and while I'm not prepared to go into detail out of respect for Angela, suffice to say that she was strong and she had stamina. She also had a remarkable appetite, not something you'd necessarily expect from a 44-year-old who shops at Etam. And while I'm no prude, far from it, I find sex extremely pleasant. For a while, I actually thought there was something wrong with her. I went back to my Blu-ray collection and re-watched the film where Michael Fassbender plays a fuckaholic, but concluded that what Angela was feeling was perfectly normal. At the end of the day, the explanation was simple. I just turned her on. After 10 days of dating, Angela and I moved in together. Some people thought it was a bit quick, but it wasn't, and they were wrong. I suggested we cohabit in my place, Denton Abbey. It's one of Norwich's marquee residential properties, and brilliant in every way. But she didn't want to. All right, then, I'll move into your place, if that's what you'd prefer, Sparrow. Sparrow is the name I would call her when we were making love. Okay, Big Bird. And Big Bird was the name she would call me. Don't get me wrong, I still think Dent Ab could work. I tended to be a quite chatty lover. But at the end of the day, you're making the final decision, and I'm 100% comfortable with that. Uh-huh. Angela tended to be less chatty. She might respond to the odd thing, but in general, once lovemaking began in anger, she preferred not to be disturbed, and I was fine with that. A lot of my utterances didn't require a response anyway. They were just reminders or items on my to-do list. The reason she wanted me to move into her house was her kids, Colby, 15, and Philip, I want to say 12, were Angela's children from her first marriage. With their father largely absent, theirs had been a topsy-turvy childhood, and Angela was keen not to inflict a house move on them, even into, like I say, one of Norwich's marquee residential properties. They were basically good kids, quite different. Philly was short, Colby had spots. Footnote. And how. But I had a lot of time for them. I'd raised a couple of teenagers of my own, so I knew more or less what to expect, but Colby and Philip were different. Admittedly, they didn't answer back their mum and had never been in trouble at school, but the fact remained that they were from a broken home. Statistically, that meant the chances of them ending up as skagheads were sky high, and I couldn't let this happen. Of course, hindsight is a wonderful thing, and looking back, I can see I may have gone in too hard. I never believed in rules for rules' sake, but I did feel it was important that they washed their hands before dinner, went into the garden if they needed to break wind, and were in their gym jams by 8 p.m. Footnote: Angela had no problem making love with me when the boys were awake, but I was less keen. I also requested that they say grace before each meal. As an atheist, I wasn't bound by this and could begin eating as soon as I sat down. And finally, that I, and I alone, had dominion over the remote control. It was in about week 4 that things started to break down. I noticed Colby, his poor face pebble-dashed with pimples, footnote, in all honesty it looked more like a crumpet than a face, had been exchanging glances with his mother over dinner. I sensed that it was time that Angela and I have a chat. So listen, I want to get things out in the open. I noticed you and Colbs looking at each other. Is everything okay, Sparrow? I decided to wait until the boys had gone to bed. Too strict. Got it. Actually had a hunch it might be something like that, but listen, that's cool with Big Bird. I'll just change tack. Maybe the guys need a bit more carrot and a bit less stick. What do you reckon? Ooh. Changing tack was a decision that would change everything. I accepted that no matter how hard I tried, I would never be their father. Yes, by easing off on the boys, there would be nothing to stop them sliding into a life of drug addiction and petty crime, but ultimately, that would be on their dad. Instead, I became a kind of best buddy to the boys, taking them out for long afternoons of bird-watching or to the miniature steam railway. Footnote: the miniature is a reference to the trains, not the steam. They'd often say it was boring and they just didn't want to go, but teenagers speak in opposites, remember, so I knew this was just their way of thanking me. I even agreed that when Colby turned 16, he'd be allowed to sit in the passenger seat on a trial basis and provided that the journey was short. It's what I like to describe as stepdadding 2.0. But the good times were not to last. I want to play your bum like bongos. It was the most foolish text I'd ever sent. I'd been out to a work do at the local swimming baths. Normally we'd just go to the pub and have a few drinks, but it was my turn to organise this one, and I felt people would benefit from doing something different for a change. What I'd forgotten was that Angela can't swim. She'd had lessons as a child, but she just kept sinking all the time. I was keen as Coleman's not to exclude her, though, so I suggested that she come along and stand in the shallow end. It was an idea that did not find favour. I felt a bit blue going on my night out without Ange, but to my surprise the evening was a roaring success. Only 4 of us made it in the end, just slightly shy of the 16 who'd said they'd come. But that actually worked to our advantage. I happened to have brought along 4 juice boxes, so after our swim, I invited the guys to sit in my car and drink them. I got on particularly well with Melanie from Accounts, and got home to find she'd texted me a picture of herself wearing a dressing gown that was slightly ajar. Anyway, we exchanged a few texts, and it was when Angela saw the one from me that said, "I'd like to play your bum like bongos," that our relationship collapsed, and she kicked me out of the house. I tried to explain to her that it was just random banter between workmates, that there was nothing going on between us, and I could just as easily have sent those texts to a man. But Angela was having none of it, and she can be quite stubborn. All in all, it was a sequence of events that would lead me to have a breakdown live on air and be suspended from my post for 2 weeks. But every cloud is said to have a lining of precious metal, typically silver, and in this case the time off allowed me to go for broke and tick off an item on my bucket list, a 3-day watercolour break on the banks of Loch Lomond, during which I listened to Hold Me Close by David Essex on loop. Footnote. Odd, because this is the song to which I fell in love with my ex-wife, Carol. She told me, in confidence, that lovemaking made her scalp sweat, so in the early days of our courtship, I'd treat her to a post-coital hairbrush. We'd sit naked on the bed with me combing her locks for bits that had become damp and tangled. This was the record we listened to. Years later, David bought a static home for me and tried to get money off because he didn't like the colour. I relented because he intimidates me. Always has. I may be wrong about this, but I'm reliably informed that he once tried to put a curse on Leo Sayer after an argument over a bill at an Indian restaurant. David still has the static home, but doesn't live in it. Having recently become an eBay power seller of Japanese car parts, he uses it to keep stock in these days. As for Angela, I still see her occasionally, not least at work every single day. She doesn't really talk to me, but I understand that, and wouldn't dream of having her sacked for insubordination. I did toy with the idea of sending her a message in this book, but my publisher felt it would be inappropriate, and I agreed. After all, even if I did have feelings for her, and that's not something I'm prepared to discuss publicly, would this really be the forum in which to say, "Angela, if you're reading this, please talk to me when I walk past you at reception. I always try to catch your eye, but you just look down, as if you're reading something, even though I know you're not." Of course it wouldn't. Ditto something like, "I know I made a mistake, I know you said you'd moved on, but I love you and I need you, and I swear on the life of my children and yours that I do not want to play that woman's bum like the bongos." No, like I say, anything in that vein would be crossing a line. Best to keep my counsel. But, while I think of it, one other thing I wouldn't have my publishers print is a quick sign-off along the lines of, "I think about you all the time. How your nose wiggles when you laugh. How you go blotchy after a hot shower. I just want to touch you, smell you, hold you tight in the pouring rain. You complete me, baby girl. Kiss." Footnote. Call me.